Welcome to the Liver Lounge, your go-to podcast for the latest updates in hepatology, featuring discussions with the world's leading experts.
Hi everyone, thanks for listening in to the latest episode of the Liver Foundation podcast. I'm Margaret, I'm from the National University Health System in Singapore, and really, really pleased today to speak with Dr. Rashid Lui. He's a specialist in gastroenterology and hepatology, and he practices in the Prince of Wales Hospital in the Chinese University of Hong Kong. So welcome, Dr. Rashid.
Hi, good evening.
So you're actually here today to discuss, I think there's a review that he co-authored that was recently published in Hepatoma Research in August of 2023. This review is entitled The Role of Gut Microbiome and Fecal Microbiota Transplantation in Liver Cancer and Related Complications, Mechanisms and Therapeutic Potentials. So, I mean, just to kind of set the stage for the rest of the discussion and also, you know, as a background to this article, maybe Dr. Rashid, as one of the regional experts and authorities in the gut microbiome, you could maybe just, you know, tell us a bit about, you know, the role and mechanisms of the gut microbiome pertaining to liver cancer.
Yeah, so thanks, Margaret, for the great question. So I think a lot of you would know liver cancer is a very big problem in this part of the world and also worldwide. It's a very common cancer, and according to which studies you're reading, it's actually the third leading cause of cancer mortality worldwide. And it's interesting to know because recent emerging evidence has shown that the gut microbiome actually plays a very pivotal role in the development of and the progression of patients who have chronic liver disease and the subsequent development of cancer. And we also know that there's actually emerging evidence that the microbiome through pleomorphic effects would be related with differences in response to treatments such as chemotherapy or emerging treatments such as immunotherapy. So this is a, I think the whole GI tract liver is actually a very exciting field now that we have a lot of new research that's being done in the gut microbiome field. And a lot of times, a lot of diseases that previously were not very well described or we don't really know the pathogenesis, somehow we can trace the origins back to the gut microbiome. So I think this is a very exciting field, and I'm looking forward to sharing more of this to the audience.
Great, that's a really good introduction. So how does the gut microbiome actually contribute to the development of liver cancer per se?
So the current literature, and as we described in the review, we have a lot of association studies that have found that patients with liver cancer actually have more dysbiosis when they're compared with the normal counterparts. So I think one of the things about gut microbiota research where we have to really be careful is there's always the question of whether it's the chicken or egg. So to really establish causality, we really need to have multiple studies, maybe done in different ethnic populations and different cancer subtypes to really establish this. But from the research, from the review and from the literature that we read, it's actually quite well established that patients with liver cancer, there is a very significant change in the microbiome of those patients. One factor that we look at would be something called alpha diversity. So what that actually means is the number of species that are present in each stool from these patients. And this has been shown to be notably reduced in patients with liver cancer. And the second thing, which is very interesting, is that some studies have actually looked at the tissue samples of the liver cancer and then tried to look at inside the tissue samples whether they're able to grow up microorganisms. And also there, the alpha diversity was also shown to be decreased. So the overall diversity is reduced in liver cancer. Secondly, studies have been done which have looked at the phylum level of the microbiota actually showed that the abundance of Firmicutes species was decreased. However, in liver cancer, there are some bacteria called proteobacteria have actually been increased in both chronic liver disease patients and also HCC patients. So we do see these perturbations in the gut microbiota across the board, and we think that it's like a spectrum. So you might get less changes when you're just having chronic liver disease. And if you progress to developing cancer, liver cancer, then these perturbations might become even more apparent. So so mainly the two points would be the loss of the diversity and also some changes in the microbiota populations.
I think it's also mentioned in your review that the changes in microbiome, actually, they differ in patients with varying etiologies of liver disease and also in different genders, right? So maybe you could comment a bit about this.
Yeah, so that was quite an interesting find that we looked at with. The gender thing was actually quite new to me. So according to the etiologies, as you may all know, the liver cancer is actually related with various different etiologies. So we have the viral hepatitis that causes liver cancer. So we have the hepatitis B, which is more prevalent in this part of the world. We have hepatitis C, which might be more relevant in the West, but because of the new direct acting antivirals, it becomes less of a public health problem. And of course, there's the problem of alcoholic related liver disease, and also the emerging pandemic of obesity and NAFLD or MAFLD, whatever you call it, metabolic associated fatty liver disease or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So during our review, we actually noted that there was actually increase in levels of some pro-inflammatory bacteria and also decreases in the levels of the anti-inflammatory bacteria in the non-hepatitis B, non-hepatitis C liver cancers. So this actually ties in quite neatly with the hypothesis that fatty liver, through mechanisms that are not quite known now, causes chronic inflammation, which progresses to fibrosis and also cirrhosis and the development of liver cancer in this particular patient group. And I think the second thing about was actually about the there were actually some gender differences that were noted as well, and it might it's widely thought that and actually it's an epidemiological observation that males do worse than females. So we're talking about mortality rates or incidence rates of liver cancer maybe 2 to 3 times that of females. Given everything else is the same. And it's now thought that maybe androgens are actually detrimental, whereas estrogen might be protective for these patients. But the microbiome angle is actually, they were noted that these might be actually related with the gender. There were some models using mice, which actually showed differences similar to that observed in humans. So that was quite an interesting find. But of course, I think one of the issues is that that's so specific, like the sex-dependent involvement of the gut microbiota, and whether this really is a leading factor causing the pathogenesis, we probably really need a lot more real-world data and also more clinical studies to confirm.
Yeah, I think a lot of these studies like are still preclinical. So like, and a lot of them is the causality has not been established as you mentioned. So I mean, this kind of relates to my next question, which is, given all that we know about the gut microbiome and its association with HCC at the moment, how do you see the field developing in terms of clinical applications? Do you think that there is some potential therapeutic target in future that we could explore in HCC?
Yeah, that's a very that's a great question, and I think we should look at the field of the gut microbiota modulation more broadly first. So first, to remind everyone that the only accepted indication currently is actually for severe refractory or recurrent Clostridial difficile infection. I think a lot of centers, including our own, and I'm sure NUH as well, we're exploring many other indications under research umbrella. So in the field of the liver disease, actually there has been some progress. There's been some studies in the West, which actually showed that giving FMT improved outcomes for patients with hepatic encephalopathy. And they were able to show that there were improvements in the dysbiosis and that the cognition of these patients were actually improved. So that's actually quite an, it's actually a very big step forward, because in the past, a lot of times, we're very worried about applying FMTs for patients with cirrhosis, because the age-old adage was that patients with liver cirrhosis are relatively immunosuppressed, and that giving FMT might be associated with infective complications. So they're able to show that the adverse events were actually not that prominent and actually did have good outcomes in terms of cognition. So I think that's really the one of the first steps in the field of chronic liver disease in cirrhosis, that FMT can be used in some of the indications. And the next question, of course, because this is mainly on liver cancer, is that actually liver cancer is just one of the presentations of end-stage liver disease of cirrhosis. So we know that 80 to 90% of these liver cancers actually arise from a advanced fibrosis and cirrhosis. So the next logical step would be, if FMT works for hepatic encephalopathy, like, would it work for in liver cancer? I think it would be a bit more difficult to dissect out the absolute benefits, but I think research should definitely be done in this space. In our review and also in the emerging literature, we know that patients or from other cancer types as well, we know that some patients respond to immunotherapy, some don't. One of the most interesting examples is some researchers in the field of melanoma. So all patients were put on immunotherapy. Some of them responded, some of them did not. They found those that responded, they harvested their gut microbiota, filtered it, everything, and they did the FMTs back to the patients who did not respond, and they were actually able to recapture response maybe, I think, in 30 or 40% of cases. So this was actually a proof of concept that the microbiota might really be playing a role in the response rates of these immunotherapies and such. And I think in liver cancer, because currently we do not have a good biomarker. So everyone, like, if you're advanced disease, first time we can just blast them with the IMbrave 150 regimen or the STRIDE regimen, which are actually both are actually immunotherapy based. So I think looking into this would be interesting, because we then know whether this concept would apply in this field. The other point would actually be side effect amelioration, because a lot of other studies have shown that doing FMT, etc., might be able to improve the side effect profile of conventional chemotherapy. Having said that, liver cancer, we seldom use conventional chemotherapy nowadays, but you can envision whether this would actually be an angle where we can ameliorate maybe side effects from the multi-kinase inhibitors, etc. So I think it's a very interesting space. And conceptually, the liver is actually a very complex organ. Like, I'm a gastroenterologist and a hepatologist, but I might not be a full-blown hepatologist. So, but from the hepatology point of view, the organ is just so complex. It produces lots of stuff. It helps with detoxification. And the interesting part is, which we also did mention in our review, is that there's actually more and more information coming up about the gut-liver axis. So, the food you take in, the microbiota, the bacteria, the virome, the fungome, etc., all inside our gut. Like, tons of these nutrients. Well, the good stuff is called nutrients, right? The bad stuff, you have a lot of all these toxins, you have a lot of this bacteria, a lot of these foreign organisms, etc., that are actually daily filtering through the liver system, through the portal system into it. And somehow the liver doesn't have an immense autoimmune response. So you can imagine it's actually a very tightly regulated system there. I'm just putting everything randomly into context. And that's one of the reasons why, actually, from in the oncology field, if you get a liver metastasis, general wisdom is that the immunotherapy doesn't work very well there, because we think it's actually, most of the time, it's actually immune cold lesions, and somehow they escaped our immune system, etc. So if a lot of this emerging data about gut microbiota, about immunology, etc., just actually makes us ask more questions about how we can keep everything in the very tight regulation, and how how everything kind of unfolds. So I think it's a very exciting field, and a lot of times we're actually looking back. So we find out that immunotherapy works, and then we try to look back and see why it works for this tumor and not for that tumor. And I think one of the things that we haven't really deciphered out is the role that the microbiota plays. And my personal opinion is that it's probably a very big role.
Wow, thanks a lot. I think you shed a lot of light in this area. Actually, I wanted to ask, you know, because you did mention that about this gut-liver axis, and prior to that, we were talking about how FMT could potentially help us select patients who, or help to, you know, improve their response to immunotherapy. How does this work? How does this work in the sense
yep.
that how does the FMT, you know, improve or help us to select patients who are better responders to immunotherapy?
Yeah, so this would actually bring up the question of whether we want to, whether it's the responders who have a specific microbiome that is more pro a anti-tumor response, or whether it's the dysbiosis in liver cancer, which we were discussing a bit more on earlier, whether it's the dysbiosis in advanced fibrosis, in cirrhosis, and eventually in liver cancer, which causes the lack of response of immunotherapy. So to my knowledge, I don't think there has been any trials currently that have taken the stools or the microbiota of really good responders of liver cancer and then put them in the patients who did not respond. But I think one way we can decipher whether that's really the case is to do something similar to the melanoma trials and to do that. The second way, which might be easier to do, is that if we assume it's the dysbiosis that's causing the lack of response, and maybe some patients respond better is because they have not such a severe dysbiosis at baseline, then we can do the FMT, the fecal microbiota transplantation, where we put in a entirely normal stools, microbiota, and we transplant it into the diseased patient. And hopefully by doing this maybe a couple of times, we're able to totally engraft in the recipient's microbiota and alter that into a more normal state. And if this somehow kicks in a very good immune response and leads to shrinkage of tumor, etc., then we would also be able to show that this is the this is probably plays in a very important. So I personally can't really tell you which way is the better way. I think from logistic point of view, because we also have a stool bank in our center in the Chinese University of Hong Kong, is that it's much easier to have a stool bank with stools that are all from healthy donors, because we ask them tons of questionnaires. We have to do a lot of screening. It's a very stringent process. And then we keep all of the stools frozen. And whenever we need it, we just pop it out. It might be logistically more difficult if we're just selecting patients who respond well. And of course, those patients who respond well actually have disease as well, right? So they're actually having advanced liver cancer or a metastatic liver cancer. That's why they're eligible for these immunotherapies plus other targeted agents. And so if you keep it away in the fridge, then you're not supposed to use this for other patients, right? Because they're we usually exclude malignancy or especially stage 4 malignancy. So we have to be very careful that the stools aren't randomly used on patients who shouldn't have received that. So I would personally think that it's easier just to revert the dysbiosis to a normal state, but whether that really does anything really needs a bit more research.
Great. And can I just ask, at your center, because you mentioned that you have your center has been doing studies on FMT in indications like for liver disease or whatnot, what would you recommend in terms of, or what would your protocol be in terms of the delivery route and how the dose and the frequency of FMT? Could you just maybe shed some light into how you guys do it? I think it's different from center to center, but it's interesting to find out your practice.
Well, it would actually... Yeah, I think it's actually depends on which study and which protocol was being used. So at our center, because we currently can't lyophilize the stools, so we're not... it's quite difficult to manufacture capsules, because in the West, a lot of times the FMTs are delivered in crapsules, because they're able to lyophilize it, put it into pills and ask the patient to like take 50 pills or something like that. So in our center, we're not doing that. So we usually apply them either by the OGD route, the esophagogastroduodenoscopy route, or we do it by colonoscopic route, and we use the scope channel to squirt in the FMT materials for both research and our service indications. We've done some studies where it's a bit more intensive. I'm sure you're aware that there have been some RCTs, most of them done in Australia, in inflammatory bowel disease and the use of FMT to induce remission. Those can be quite intense. Like they're talking about maybe weekly FMTs to engraft. We haven't run a trial that intense yet, but we have some that do require multiple sessions, and multiple sessions do require the patient to be very keen on the treatment and also willing to adhere to the schedule, because you can imagine bringing someone in for like repeated FMTs, and if they just they just drop out of the time. But at our center, because of the limitations of manufacturing it into or encapsulating it, then we usually use endoscopy routes. I know that some centers would actually use the feeding tube, but we don't do that anymore. Initial, our first few cases, we did use the nasoduodenal tube for the application of the FMT, similar to the Denmark paper from Van Ude in the New England Journal. But then we found it was actually quite of a hassle. The infusion was quite slow, and patients, if they pulled it out, then you'll be in quite messy, right? You'll be dripping FMT material everywhere. And sometimes we put in the nasoduodenal tube, and because it's not dripping quick enough, we ask the patient just to continue back into the wards. And then the ward nurses don't really like seeing a bag of good stuff dripping in. So a lot of hassle. And so in the end, just doing the endoscopy, just delivering it in the scope channel, and then you just put the patient back in recovery, and be a lot easier. So that's a bit of experience from our center.
Great, thanks a lot for sharing your center's experience. And I think actually we've done quite a bit in these 10 or 15 minutes or so. We've covered quite a lot of ground in terms of the applications of how the gut microbiome can potentially influence the development of HCC, and we talked also a bit about FMT, which is a kind of emerging concept in the field of, I think, more established in HE, but now in HCC. So I think before we conclude this podcast, Dr. Rashid, is there anything else you would like to say to our readers pertaining to the gut microbiome in liver disease?
Yeah, so I think at the end of the day, the gut microbiome is actually influenced by like what we eat, medications, antibiotics, food additives, etc. And so I think at the end of the day, despite all of this high-end science, a lot of these trials are using a lot of these 16S metagenomics, Shaka metagenomics, this and that. At the end of the day, the conclusions that we'll probably be getting would actually be back to the basics. So eating healthily, having exercise, don't be obese, don't lead a sedentary lifestyle, like have a lot of fruits and vegetables, antioxidants, etc. Don't drink sweet beverages, sugared drinks, etc. So I think, I think we can see the paradigm in different diseases as well. Sometimes it takes a lot of this high science stuff to really persuade the population to do these relatively simple things more effectively. So I think at the end of the day, this is probably going to be the message. We'll probably be able to find some bacteria that are enriched, some that are less enriched. But at the end of the day, this probably will tie into like bad lifestyles and stuff like that, smoking, alcohol, and everything. So it's just a very... I think it would be a very expensive and fancy way just to tell everyone that you should not smoke, you should not drink that much, you should do more exercise, have a balanced diet, etc. But so primary prevention is always something I always remind, like whenever I'm doing these kinds of things, which is very important because prevention is always much cheaper and much better than cure. You don't want to be thinking about FMTs to boost your immunotherapy for a unresectable liver cancer when you could have prevented it by doing a lot of simple things for a long time. Certainly, I think the field will continue to progress, and my hope is that we're really able to run some studies that show that FMT or some sort of gut microbiota modulation can really lead to a good impact on the clinical outcomes of these patients. Because despite advances in immunotherapy, in surgery or different modalities of treatment, liver cancer is still a very lethal disease. And we really need all the weapons we can get to help these patients and hopefully lead to not just longer term survivalists, but better quality of life.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Rashid. And just a really final question, something that I'm sure many general gastroenterologists would be dying to ask you. What is your thought on probiotics and would you recommend these to your patients? You know, especially for those with liver disease and, you know, some of the patients have been reading up and they realize, you know, there's some issues with gut dysbiosis and they have read that certain types of probiotics can help to supplement your microbiome and you know, have beneficial outcomes. Well, what are your thoughts on this, and do you actually prescribe them to your patients?
I think it was a bit lagging, so I think if I got the question right, it was asking on the role of probiotics in this in liver cancer in this clinical setting. And I can only say that I think the current evidence, it's still too early to draw finite conclusions. And I think it's very difficult because any specific probiotics, there's actually always been some concern. That's going back to the point is where we're saying the US researchers are actually very brave, because the old concept that cirrhosis is like relatively immunosuppressed, and patients, like people were worried that even if you're giving probiotics or this and that, it might even lead to sepsis or stuff like that. But I think in the FMT trials that were done, it's shown that even doing full-blown FMT was actually quite safe in this population group. So I think we really have to think more broadly, and we don't really have to be that afraid of adjusting that. Having said that, I think really identifying the exact bacterial strain or probiotic that would lead to would solve all the liver disease problems is the holy grail in hepatology. I think we're not there yet. And this question actually, as you mentioned, always pops up. Not just general gastroenterologists, all patients that come in and they're saying, I watched this on TV, I read this on the web or whatever. And we usually just like the generic saying is that, oh, if you've taken it and you think you feel better, then it's fine. If not, you tried it for a while and you don't think it's really helping, I think it's just don't waste your money. So I think we're not quite there yet, but this does tie into the bigger picture of we know that there are dysbiosis, but exactly which one, is it just the diversity or is it a really structured, or is it every patient is different? We're still not entirely sure. And it's not just the microbiome, as mentioned, the fungal, virome, everything is probably perturbated. How to restore that back into a healthy state is going to be the research direction and the mission for a lot of people in our field.
Yeah, so it's really exciting days for researchers in the gut microbiome space. So thanks a lot, Dr. Rashid, for your time today and for enlightening us with all your knowledge in this field.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure, and I really think this is a very interesting part of our work, and we can really see that it's translatable, and we're able to tie in everything. I think at the end of the day, a lot of diseases, people are saying that autoimmune diseases, cancers, everything, at the end, it ties back to the gut, which I think is true. But because everything is so complicated and everything is so new, at the end, we're never gonna, I personally think we're never gonna get the answer of A will equal to B and you handle A and then you won't develop B. It's never gonna be that simple. But I think the concept that everything at the end of the day is back to the guts, and that's why gastroenterologists and hepatologists are gonna play an increasingly important role in health, and not just the GI tract, in all diseases.
We have come to the end of the episode. Thank you for joining us, and stay tuned for more captivating discussions.